and welcome back to the Property and Lending Podcast. It's been a few weeks because one of our speakers, Fendi's been globetrotting around Egypt and Dubai and the Middle East. So we're grateful to have you back. You've given us some of your time. We thought we'd take it back to basics and going to talk about stuff that people ask questions about. So one of the things that I get asked a lot about, and I know Fendi, you had a client recently asked the same thing, was about investing in an apartment. So we thought we'll do an episode about apartments from a property perspective. Are they good investments and whatnot? And from a lending perspective, what that world looks like. So I might just straight away ask a pretty basic question: Is lending for an apartment any different to lending for a resident for a regular house?
There are a few other, let's say, part of policy in regards to purchasing an apartment. For example, what's the square meter of the apartment? Most lenders would need a minimum of 40 to 50 square meter, not including the veranda. Some lenders would need a minimum of 40, 50 square meter, including the verandas. Also, in regards to high-rise buildings, in postcodes, for example, if you ask Mark, if he had a client before looking to purchase in a postcode of Rhodes, in the Homebush area as well, there's postcode restrictions there, which will put on LVR restrictions as well, which we all know is the loan to value ratio as well. So there are quite a few restrictions attached to apartments that are not attached to obviously purchasing a normal property, a detached home or a duplex or a townhouse.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty interesting, the square meter rate. And so essentially what you're saying, if it's less than 40 square meters, or I know in certain aspects 38, but whatever the threshold is, the bank just simply won't give you the money. Is that correct?
Well, most of them, yeah. Like a big portion of them would. And the banks that would be willing to give you the money is banks that don't really use too often. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we talk about postcode restrictions, is that the same concept where, you know, whatever postcode 2000, if there's a restriction on the bank, again, no matter what you're buying, whatever apartment you're buying in that location, again, the bank's just going to say no, irrespective of the deal itself?
They'd say nicely no, and they'll probably much say if you do want to go ahead with this purchase, you're looking at maybe a 60, Mark was it before, 60 to 70% LVR in those high-rise or high-density areas in regards to the postcode restrictions?
Depends. Like I had one recently in Melbourne CBD, and the LVR restriction for this one was 80%. And for that particular one, it was interesting because it was a Medico client buying it. So there was not going to be LMI. He was buying at 90% LVR and there wasn't going to be LMI. They still said, we didn't actually submit, but we checked beforehand and there's no budget room. So even if there's no LMI and you have an LMI waiver, but the restriction is at 80%, they will not accept it. It's not an acceptable security for the lender.
And Mark, are they putting these restrictions on? I guess they're seeing these investments as a higher risk, and therefore they're worried that they will not be able to recoup their money if they needed to.
Yeah, I think it's based on the resale value. And the last time with that Melbourne example, what they actually informed, what they told me is they sent me an Excel spreadsheet. This particular lender, one of the big lenders, and they go to me, just look up the exact address of the block of the apartment block in this Excel spreadsheet, and essentially it will tell you exactly how many units are mortgaged to that particular lender, and if it is exceeding a certain number, it's seen to be even more risky for the bank, because if, knock on wood, all those people go bankrupt and all of them go on the market, it's going to be obviously very hard to get top dollar on 40 identical apartments in the one block to be sold within close proximity.
Yeah, okay. So it might sometimes be a matter of a different lender, because they don't have as much risk to that particular block. But at the end of the day, the bank is looking at this as a higher risk opportunity. Is that correct?
Yeah, there definitely are smaller lenders that will do it. Definitely there are smaller lenders that will do it. But what I always tell my clients is if the bank doesn't want to put, I think we said that on the show before, if the banks don't want to put their name on it, me personally, I wouldn't want to put my name on it. So I don't know, it's up to the customer. But yeah, it does tell you something about the property.
Yeah, that's a good point. And someone asked me the other day, I mean, we had a client who had some issues with their finances regarding a deal. It wasn't an apartment. And someone asked me, doesn't the bank want to make money? And I said, well, the bank wants to make money, but they want to make sure they can get that money, right? They're not just giving out money that may or may not come back. So I think that's a good point. And yeah, we definitely said that before on the pod. You know, if the banks are a bit worried, we should be too. From our perspective, we don't really buy apartments for clients at all. Very specific cases we would consider, but in a general aspect, we won't buy them for a few reasons, and some of them you guys have already touched on. From a bank's perspective, is the same reason why we don't buy them. Definitely anything like a medium to high rise building, we won't touch. And the biggest reason is, I guess, supply and demand, and that comes down to everything in economics. Anything to do with money comes down to supply and demand. And when you have a medium to high rise building, when you've got 30, 50, 100 units in the same building, there's a lot of demand. And often they're all the exact same. You know, there's no difference between two units. Might be different levels, different floors, but the unit designs are very, very similar. So you have no scarcity. So when you have an abundance of demand, if all three of us had an apartment in a building and we were all selling at the same time, and I was the most desperate to sell for whatever reason, and there was one buyer that came through all three, and Mark, you were selling it for 600 and Freddie had it for 590, but I was really desperate and I had it for 520 because I just need a quick sale. He's obviously going to come to me because your apartments are the exact same. There's no reason to be charging an extra 60 grand. Suddenly, I've sold it for 520. Your property is now worth 520. No matter what you want for it, now it's worth that because there's no scarcity. So the supply and demand factor is always a big problem. The other side to it is when we buy investments, we're looking for properties that have owner-occupier appeal because that's got an emotional attachment to it and people pay emotional prices. Very rarely do people have emotional attachments to a unit because of that same reason, there's no scarcity. And then the third reason, one of the biggest reasons as well, is you don't own anything. You know, you don't own any land. And, you know, I guess that's what Ferdy was saying before about the square meter restriction. They're saying minimum 40 square meters. Even if you have 40 square meters, you own 40 square meters of airspace, really, because you can't do anything with that land. You can't renovate. You can't change much structurally or anything structurally, potentially internal cosmetics, but you'd have to go through a lot of the time strata and body corporate to see what you can and can't do. And so you have very little ownership of what you own, really. So we don't really like those kinds of investments. So we don't really buy them. People don't really make money. Actually, lots of times people lose money because what will happen is you buy into this building, and then you can always build more buildings going up. You can't build more land. You can always build up, though. So what happens is people buy, then 3-4 years later, there's a brand new building being built, and now yours is old and that's new for the same price. Why would I buy the old one? Right, so it goes back to that supply and demand and scarcity. The times that we would look at it is, we're talking before the show started, Mark, about someone you were listening to about buying a full block of units potentially. And we're talking like a small block, potentially of 4 or 6, and we're talking keep units.
Before, because I know you're going along with this, keep in mind that was purchased when, Mark, in 2008?
Yeah, it was 2008.
Now banks have put restrictions in regards to how many units you can purchase in the same block as well.
Would it change to commercial lending?
You have to purchase it as a more of a commercial property if you're looking to purchase, you know, a few blocks. But now, and I don't usually agree with the banks in regards to some of their policies, but I do agree in regards to these apartment blocks, in regards to apartment purchasing as well, and you probably agree with the same thing, the both of you, is that You touched on a very good point in regards to someone just selling their property way below value. Now that becomes the new value of all the apartments in that same block. Also, even if you purchase an investment, you think you're going to get rental income from that investment properties. What about apartment block has more than, with some lenders, if there's more than 40 apartments in the same block, they're not doing it at all. What if in that apartment block, someone else is renting your property out for a lot more cheaper as well? And you're not going to be getting that rental return that you've put on your pre-approval as the rental appraisal that we, you know, we use very, very highly in regards to getting that loan service, is not going to be returned back to you. When's the negative gearing? Where's that all those tax benefits going to be coming back to you as well? And the resale price, worst case scenario, like you said, KM, moving forward, Are you going to be able to sell that property? Are you going to be able to sell that apartment? Who's looking to purchase an apartment in a high-rise building or purchasing an apartment to live in or as an investment if it's not being rented out by yourself initially? So
yeah. For sure. No, I agree with you. And so the only two times I guess we would look at it on our perspective is, one, when there is a really small block and you're buying the entire block and it's for a cash flow play and you don't have any plans of selling anything, you know, and we're talking a block of four, and you can buy the entire block, and you know, whether you're funding that cash or you're getting a loan, even if you're higher LVR, sometimes it works at the end of a portfolio looking for a cash cow. The other time is when you're only buying one unit, but there is an element of scarcity, and usually that element of scarcity comes again from a small building where you're overlooking the water, for example, and they will never ever be able to build in front of that. If you're overlooking the harbour, Sydney Harbour, and you've got a, you know, 1 in 6 unit and you know they can't build in front of you, you're always going to have that view that is scarce that no one else can have. So now you do have an element of supply that people do want because of that view, for example. But these are obviously very rare cases. So in general, we don't really buy these assets. And a lot of people ask, oh, shouldn't I be buying isn't it better to buy a unit for 600 grand or whatever in Sydney City or Alexandria or whatever, where there's 2,000 buildings, as opposed to this house that you're telling me to buy in Brisbane or Adelaide, that's 25Ks or 20Ks from the city. And 99.99% of the time, the answer is no. So that's from our perspective and investment perspective, we really don't touch investments. It's a pretty easy, quick no when we look at these options. But I definitely agree with you, and from your perspective of from lending, there's definitely a consideration, because a lot of the times if we are looking at a full block or units, it's a cash buyer. It's not someone getting lending. I mean, there's not really much to add from my perspective on that. Do you guys have anything to add from a lending perspective on units, apartments?
Even small blocks, the only thing I've got to add is just keep in mind if you're looking to purchase an apartment, even if it's for owner-occupied, take all the points that we discussed today, and in regards to lending, just that's where you definitely would need a pre-approval in regards to if you're looking to purchase an apartment, because you want to make sure that you've got that pre-approval in place with the correct lender. Also, you have to take into account deposits. Is it going to be really worth it if you're purchasing an apartment to move into, but you have to put down between 20 to 30% of deposit in there? I'm definitely not, not just me, a lot of lenders and most of us are not big fans of high-rise buildings, because then again, you've just got the exact same apartment. How many apartments? Like the last time I've gone into one of those apartment boxes, it was like 8 apartments on each floor, and it was, I think it's 15 or 16 floors altogether. And they were all pretty much the exact same apartment. So that's where you need to take into consideration. Worst case scenario, if I want to try and rent it out, or if I want to try and sell it in the future, The way the lenders look at it is that you're going to struggle to try and get rid of that apartment, whether you're trying to rent it out or you're trying to resell it.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say there's two things. So the first thing, lending perspective, a lot of the time, funnily enough, you can't actually borrow as much if you're buying an apartment because that extra strata expense. So I personally don't like strata because I can't control how much it is. And if there's an issue with the whole building, they can knock at your door at any time and be like, hey, the sinking fund is low. We need an extra $600 this quarter on top of strata, and you can't really say anything. So that's the first thing. So your strata expense, which is going to be different building to building, needs to be made very clear to your broker before you sign the contract, because it will impact how much you can borrow. If you're trying to hit the limit, like of what your borrowing capacity is, any little increase can sort of cause you issues. Second thing I was going to ask is actually a question. So the only time I'm just thinking when it does make sense to build, to buy an apartment, we have a lot of buyers now, first home buyers that can go under the scheme. They have to buy under 900 grand under the first home guarantee scheme in New South Wales or in the city. And they're finding, because their borrowing capacity is getting smashed every month with the rates going up and it's not looking like it's going to hold up. A lot of the time they can get into an apartment in the area they want, but not a house, but they'll, have stamp duty minimized because it's, you know, depending on their purchase price. And also they're only putting 5% down with no LMI as well. So there's the upfront expenses a lot less. What do you think about that, Cam? Would that make sense for a business?
Yeah, I know we've shared a few of these clients. And typically what we will do from our perspective is we'll run a data analysis to see, okay, if you purchase this apartment at 900 grand and only put 5% down and save just stamp duty, what are the returns that we expected to receive over the next few years from a capital growth perspective as well as a cash perspective? Obviously, buying it as a, you know, under the first home scheme, they're buying as an owner occupier, so they wouldn't be able to rent this out, you know, for a little while until they decide to move out. And then we will compare, okay, if they were purchasing a regular investment and were to put a regular deposit and pay stamp duty, what's their borrowing power? You would tell me that. And then we would run a data analysis again across the country and say, okay, you might only have 550 grand now in this scenario. For 550, we can buy in XYZ areas. And the expected returns are, you know, this much. And often, more often than not, and probably, well, I haven't seen a scenario yet where the apartment made more sense, it was actually better off to pay the stamp duty, borrow less money, because you might save stamp duty on a 900 grand purchase would be whatever, 25, 30 grand in Sydney, maybe a little bit more, but you're not going to make any money. In 3 years' time, that property will be worth the same, if not less, and your rent returns are going to be pretty small considering Sydney's yields. Whereas if you're buying something for 550 and we're getting, you know, 25 to 30% growth over the next 3 years, you're going to make 200 grand in capital growth, if not more, and you're going to get 4.5% yields, you know, keep your neutral cash flow as well. So a lot of the time, yeah, I understand, because we get that, we have that conversation every single day with first-time buyers or first-time investors where they say, well, should I buy something in Sydney or whatever state they're from? Usually it's a Sydney problem because other states have decent returns in terms of a yield. And every single time the results show that you're better off spending less and making more, because at the end of the day, it's a game of making money, not a game of saving stamp duty. And it's a bit annoying sometimes because now, oh, I have to pay stamp duty. But if you're paying 20 grand stamp duty and in return you're making 250, 300 grand over the next 3 years, there's no real problem there. So the answer would be to run a data analysis and compare. But every single time so far we've done it has shown it's better off not to buy those apartments.
Yeah.
Almost every time. Yeah. And one thing you mentioned that I forgot to mention as well was the strata. And there is examples, like I know someone who owns a unit in a three-building complex. And the particular building he has, the particular building his unit is in was really old. So there was no lift or elevator or anything like that. But the other two buildings do have elevators. And there's also a swimming pool and a gym. And his strata includes maintaining those lifts, swimming pools, and gym, but he doesn't have a lift. He's not even getting the benefit from that strata. This happens quite often, actually, where people buy and they strata, you know, you're part of the complex, so you've got to pay strata for everything. So a lot of times you're paying strata on stuff you don't even get to use. Especially if you're putting tenants in there, not many people use these public or these complex swimming pools and tennis courts and whatever, and you're just paying a lot of money for absolutely no reason, which eats into your returns as well. So strata is definitely a big issue with these buildings as well. So, and the bigger they get, the more expensive the strata is. And one of the just when Freddie, you were speaking, it reminded me of something. One of the common questions we get asked is about buying it. I would assume, I'm just going to guess, could be wrong, that there's a postcode restriction here, but buying an apartment in like Surfers Paradise. Wouldn't it be great to buy an apartment in Surfers Paradise and Airbnb it, and then we'll use it? And there's so many problems with that way of thinking, because firstly, when you want to use it is when everyone else wants to use it during summer. So you're going to be there, then during the rest of the year, it's going to be empty. And then the other thing is it's the same problem with supply and demand. And then your strata cost in these Surfers Paradise apartments, I can only imagine, would be through the roof with pools and lifts and gyms and tennis courts and the whole shebang. So that, you know, just came to mind when you were speaking about it. Another thing we get asked a lot about is that strategy. definitely a big no-no from our perspective.
Fair enough. What was I going to say with strata? And the tenant, I'm just going to add, and the tenants don't pay for the strata, the landlord does. So if the strata keeps going up, you can increase your rent every 12 months, whatever the rule is, but you can't impose the strata to be paid by the tenants.
That as well, and the big one that just KM just mentioned in regards to the strata, not only is it just going up, you're not utilizing it. Like, you're pretty much paying upgrades and renovations and whatever it may be for someone else to utilize it. And as well, when you're purchasing an apartment, I actually ran into this one, with an existing customer, and Adriana was actually, the conveyancer we had on before that we all use was actually the one that taking care of this application for me. And lucky she picked it up. And this, again, goes back to having the correct conveyancer, looking at the contract to sell. They're actually going to be doing work that needed to be done after maybe 2 to 3 months of purchase, where Adrian actually brought this up with the customer, negotiated a lower amount because obviously my customer was just going to be moving in. And why should she be paying for the full renovations going in if she's going to be moving in? It should be covered. A portion of it should have been covered by the existing tenants, which was part of the reason why they were looking to sell that apartment as well. And that one was in, a very renowned area here in Sydney as well, where she purchased the apartment. So that's another thing that needs to be looked at going through, obviously buyers that are coming through to UK, through to KM as well, is future renovations, future like updates of the apartments, how fast or how soon would those customers be up for paying for those sort of things after purchase? Because they can be purchasing, if it wasn't for the conveyancer or Adriana picking this up, my client would have moved in and she would have to be up for quite a bit of coin 2 to 3 months after purchasing that apartment when she has no say about it as well. So yeah, that's another thing as well.
It's a good point. When we're buying a residential, like a house, we get a building and pest report. When you're looking at an apartment, there's a strata report that you can request. And they're quite complex, these strata reports. And you don't actually know sometimes what relates to you and what doesn't relate to you. So you definitely need to get your solicitor to have a look at that. And a lot of the time there's hidden costs and just things you're not even sure why you're paying it. And like Mark said, if there's not enough money in the fund, we need more money. What for? It's just sitting there just in case, but we need more money. And it's sort of like, from an owner-occupied perspective, obviously it's a different conversation if that's really what you want to live in and it's your, that's your choice. But from an investment perspective, it's definitely – it just doesn't make sense at all. So don't buy apartments is the takeaway from this podcast.
Actually, funnily enough that you mentioned the sinking fund, I just saw, I had a customer that I'm working with now, and he sent me his, the bank asked to see the last strata invoice. And then on his last strata, so I asked him beforehand, how much do you pay for strata? And he told me, send me the invoice. And I'm like, hey, it's $500 more than you said. Is this like normal? Is this like a every month thing? And then you look at the breakdown of the cost, and those $500, and next to it just said sinking fund. And then I'm like, hey, can you send me the last two before this one? He's like, yeah, he sent me the two before, and he also got charged an extra $500 on those ones. And then when he asked Strata, they've essentially used the funds for something, and now they need to replenish the funds just in case for the next thing that comes up. So even though there's no expense right now, they need to replenish the funds in the event they need to use it. So again, zero control over these sporadic movements in strata.
No control, and it just completely kills your cash flow. I mean, I know we have clients, and sometimes maintenance comes up when you own a property. It's just part of building a portfolio, and sometimes they get a bit upset. And I wonder, imagine you had to pay this $500 for no reason. You probably wouldn't be very happy. So, yeah, big takeaway, don't buy apartments.
The most important part as well to think about is that everyone on the podcast today has actually discussed about customers about trying to save money on the stamp duty, trying to save money on the LMI, deposits, whatever it may be. These are all short-term problems. Trying to get to an apartment because it's cheaper, trying to purchase because it's lower, stamp duty for first-time buyers. In the scheme of things, and Kane, you say this to most of, all of our customers pretty much, it's all about long-term. This is a 30-year investment. The loan term is a 30-year loan term. So if you're trying to get into an apartment now just because you want to get into the market or trying to save costs as a first-time buyer, then like you always say, but let's look interstate. Let's look somewhere else where you can actually purchase at a higher rental yield. You actually have land. You can have some sort of capital growth. It's not just I love that when you use it's just not air. Like it's just not just a one or two bedroom apartment, or it might even be a studio. Like if you're purchasing anything under 40 square meter, that's a studio apartment. And that's something the lenders pretty much don't lend to.
Yeah, for sure. And it's, I mean, we say this to every single client. We're buying this for the long term. Sometimes clients get a little bit obsessive over, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 when we're in a negotiation, and you think, well, in 30 years' time, you're not going to remember that extra $1,000 or $2,000. You probably won't remember it in 2 years' time, let alone 30. And you know, the biggest power of buying real estate is compound growth and compound interest. So it's all long term. We definitely don't make short term decisions, and apartments a lot of the time are these short term decisions. So yeah, you're 100% right. It's all long term. You know, sometimes it's just we've knocked back clients. You know, we love working with clients, and the more the merrier, but we've knocked back clients because it's not the right time. And if you don't have enough money, the right thing for you to do is keep saving up. You know, we'll work with you when you're ready. And I'm sure you guys get this all the time from your perspective. You just don't have enough to, or you can't service enough, or you don't have a big enough deposit, whatever it is. If this isn't the right time, it'll come. You don't have to really worry about timing the market, as we've said so many times. It's all about long term. So yeah, definitely, you know, we don't buy property to save tax. We don't buy property to save stamp duty. We buy property to make money.
Yeah.
Well, if no one's got anything else to add, Ferdy is very busy. He has to run away to another country or something. So another holiday.
I'll tell you what, if you bought an apartment in Egypt 4 or 5 years ago, you've made £1 million in the last 4 to 5 years.
Egypt has a different economic state to Australia.
There's like loans. You buy them outright.
We won't get into it. But thank you, guys, as always. It's a pleasure to have you back, Ferdy.
Thank you.
I was getting, you know, I had to talk to Mark for like a couple of weeks without, you know, anyone interviewing. No, but I'm sure the listeners will be glad to have us back. I've had a few people message us saying where you're at. So it's good to be back, and see you guys next week.
Take care. Thank you. Thank you.